You've heard of Grammarly, and you might think it's a fancy spell check, but people on your team have been using it and loving it for years, because it does way more than you realise. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that works seamlessly across apps and websites and can write an instant first draft in a few clicks, not a few hours. When every word your team writes is clear, concise, and on brand, companies can save 19 days per employee per year. Learn what better writing can do for your company at Grammarly.com. Grammarly, easier said, done.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy, of advancing education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
From the heart of where innovation, money, and power collide, in Silicon Valley and beyond, this is Bloomberg Technology with Emily Chang.
Chang in San Francisco, and this is Bloomberg Technology. Coming up in the next hour, Snap misses, and big, and even CEO Evan Spiegel says he's not happy about the results. Plus, the company gives no third quarter forecast. Just how deep are advertisers slashing their budgets? We will discuss. Plus, consumers are so strapped for cash, they're pushing back cell phone payments, and that's hurting AT&T's bottom line. Shares dropping the most in 2 decades. I'll ask AT&T CEO John Stankey what this tells him about the state of the economy. And big tech is on a health kick. Amazon is buying One Medical in a $3.5 billion deal. The news a day after Apple published a 60-page report about its own dominance in the sector. We will head to the front lines of a new showdown. All of that in a moment, but I do want to talk a little bit more about Snap now. Bring in Jasmine Enberg, principal analyst at Insider Intelligence. Look, Jasmine, just how bad a signal does this send?
Well, this isn't totally unexpected. I think the big question was how big of a slump it would be. And now it's just become increasingly clear that all these macroeconomic challenges are really putting pressure on Snap's ad business. Now, Snap has staked its future on augmented reality, which holds promise, but it is still very niche as an advertising and an e-commerce tool. And at the same time, we also have Apple's privacy changes, which have disproportionately affected performance advertisers. So it's really creating this 1-2 punch to Snapchat's ad business. Now, Snap, of course, is a small player in the digital ad market. At Insider Intelligence, we expect Snap to make up just 1% of worldwide digital ad revenues this year, which means it could be more susceptible to a lot of these challenges than bigger players, for example.
Well, that's the question. Is this just Snap, or is this going to impact everyone else? And are we going to see this in the results of Facebook and Meta, and Google and Twitter, for example? Stocks of all of these companies dropped on the back of Snap's results as well. How contagious, if you will, is this?
Yeah, I think we'll be hard-pressed to find any social platform that hasn't struggled in Q2. I'm not expecting fantastic results for any of these companies. But again, it's the smaller players that tend to be more vulnerable to a lot of these challenges than the larger ones.
How much competition do you foresee from streaming services in the ad business with Netflix, Disney, HBO, all exploring these ad-supported models? Is that now a new battleground?
So I cover social media companies, and I don't cover Netflix and other streaming companies, but I will say that the more consumer attention is divided onto these different platforms And the more options advertisers have on where to spend their ad dollars, especially with a lot of these issues like the like Apple's privacy changes that are impacting the social media companies, the more likely it is that they will diversify their spending and perhaps spend elsewhere.
What can we anticipate from Twitter results coming out tomorrow? Obviously, we know Twitter won round one in court, and that sideshow is going to be going on now for several more months at least.
Yeah, I'm not expecting really great things for Twitter tomorrow. It has been distracted for most of Q2 with the whole Musk ordeal, and that has made it harder for it to really focus on growing its business and its revenues. Twitter is also a small player in the digital ad market. It will also make up around 1% of total worldwide digital ad revenues this year per our forecast. So it is vulnerable to a lot of these macroeconomic challenges as well as other changes in online privacy and shifts in consumer behavior.
All right, Jasmine Emberg, Insider Intelligence Principal Analyst, thank you as always for your insights. We'll continue to listen in to Snap's call. It was a strong earnings report, but a bleak outlook. AT&T just had its worst open in 20 years as rising prices from gas to groceries weigh on customers. AT&T cut its free cash flow forecast by $2 billion, saying more people are putting off paying their bills. Joining me now, John Stankey, the CEO of AT&T. So, John, look, investors were a little spooked by what they saw today. What's your response to their response?
Well, I think the investors looked at the cash number and they were, you know, certainly it was a bit out of pattern for our second quarter, and I acknowledge it is. And as I described this morning during the call, a lot of it was by our choice. One, you know, we had record customer growth and we had to fund that customer growth, and that requires cash out the door. And that's not business I'm going to walk away from. And frankly, the numbers and the economy is a bit stronger right now than we had anticipated last year when we set the plan. And I think it's a good thing we've got the customers coming in the door, but it did have a negative impact on cash. Secondly, we're investing at record levels in the business, and we front-end loaded our capital plan this year, which from our perspective is probably a good thing. It allows us to sell into that inventory and drive more broadband subscribers, and we were able to get more 5G coverage out there to our customers on mid-band spectrum than what we had planned. That also took cash. The one element that I think you're referring to is we did see customers take a little bit longer to pay their bills, and that had a working capital impact, but we were pretty clear that we weren't saying customers weren't paying their bills, and we weren't saying that activity was slowing down. We just said simply that we've got customers taking a little bit longer to pay their bills, and there was a working capital impact. And in a business our size, you know, when you end up seeing them take a day or two longer to pay, that's a significant impact to the cash flow.
Now, what's also really interesting here is this is a fairly recent trend that you've been seeing just over the last several weeks. A day or two, maybe not a huge deal, but what are the chances these delays get longer? Or are you expecting some of these customers potentially to cancel?
I think we don't expect these customers to cancel. We've had, you know, a lot of experiences going through economic downturns. Probably, depending on what point of view you hold of the economy in the future right now, looking at projections, certainly people are talking either soft landing or avoiding a recession altogether. So, you know, we've been through much more severe cycles, and what we know is that customers really want to keep their connectivity services. They stick through, and that's why I said we don't view this as a cataclysmic problem at all. We see customers choosing to take a couple more days to pay their bills, creating a working capital problem, not a bad debt issue. And, you know, whether or not it gets more severe, I mean, I'm not a fortune teller. I wouldn't anticipate that in the economy right now based on the numbers we're seeing, but we do expect a more tepid environment looking forward, and that tepid environment, you know, could slow down economic activity a little bit. It could extend things a little bit. We've taken a conservative view on our forecast right now. We feel pretty comfortable that we've got that under control for the balance of this year.
You've cut your free cash flow forecast, but you've maintained your capital spending plans. As you've been talking about, you are investing in the business. Will you have to cut the dividend?
No, we don't have to cut the dividend. We have plenty of coverage on the dividend. We adjusted the dividend coming out of the Warner Brothers Discovery transaction. We just paid down over $40 billion of debt on the balance sheet, saw a great improvement to our adjusted net debt to EBITDA. As a result of that, we've got a lot of free cash flow cushion. We are investing at a record pace, both in customer growth and in our networks. As we've explained to our investor base, that's not a forever rate of investment right now. We're repositioning the business. We're penetrating with fiber. We're improving some of our internal processes to take costs out. Those will start to yield dividends back into our business in terms of better operating performance and better operating leverage, as we've characterized for the balance of this year. We'll have plenty of room to cover the dividend, and we have plenty of room to invest in this business at a robust clip moving forward. We feel very comfortable about that.
You had said you were considering raising prices again. Are you still considering raising prices? And if so, by how much and when?
Emily, I think what I said is that any company that gets into an environment where there's extended high inflation rates has to be aware of running both sides of the equation, not only being vigilant about costs and trying to make sure that they're on a perpetual cycle to take costs out of the business, but also being aware that if you're in a long extended inflationary cycle, sometimes you have to work the revenue side of the equation too. And you know, we did one of our first actions earlier this year, and we, I think, frankly engineered that as a win-win for customers. We did have to take some prices up, but we were also able to give the customer some more value as we took prices up, some new features and plans and services that they could migrate into. I don't know what the next 12 months has in store. If it extends on, will we see 9% inflation? Will we have to consider possibly some other actions on pricing? I would say that's not off the table. Right now, we haven't made any decisions around that, or we don't have any specific plans.
Curious if you think this is an industry-wide issue. Would you be surprised if T-Mobile and Verizon don't see customers putting off their bills?
I don't know what T-Mobile or Verizon is going to report. I know what I reported, and I know what our data is, and I can tell you that our customers, you know, basically have extended their payment cycle by about 2 days. And as I said, I'm not concerned about that given past history. I'm also looking at it relative to pre-pandemic levels, and it's not grossly out of line with pre-pandemic levels. What I can tell you is AT&T is kind of a mini microcosm of society and our customer base. I would think what we're seeing is kind of representative of the broader economy, but I don't know that for a fact. I just know the data I've got on my customers.
All right. You've got a 23-state footprint in fiber, and I know one of your big ambitions is to make AT&T the best broadband provider in the United States. The competitive landscape is changing here and fast. Are you looking to buy or build beyond what you've done so far?
You know, it's a really good question, Emily. I think they'll put this in perspective from January of this year to today, as we've reported. We've grown over 2 million connected locations on our fiber network, and we're now at 18 million connected locations. We are the scaled fiber provider in the United States, and we are building at a rate faster than anybody else that's deploying fiber. Our organic growth is what's powering this business right now. Our ability to muscle a supply chain, the resources, and the capabilities to go out and build more infrastructure. And that is really the foundation of what we need to do moving forward. There are other people that deploy fiber in the United States. Frankly, most of them are subscale compared to us. And when we're having the success we're having, doing the things that we do well, engineering great fiber networks, learning how to penetrate them quickly, working through this on an organic basis, frankly, is probably the right play for us right now.
Now, AT&T got out of the media business with the big sale of Time Warner, and since then we've seen streaming giants, media companies really struggle. What did you and AT&T see that, for example, Netflix didn't?
Oh, I think Netflix is, you know, to be praised and admired for what they've managed to create as a business. I mean, they've been a very successful company, and they have built a new model that will be the dominant model of distributing entertainment content and all consumption of video content for a decade to come. And what I would tell you that I think we viewed as possibly being a little bit different and a little more quickly is many times I said I felt it was really important that these streaming platforms have a two-sided model, both subscription and advertising. And, you know, clearly reports are, and the company itself has said, Netflix is going to actually start to introduce advertising in their platform. I frankly think that'll be good for them over the long haul. It allows them to start thinking about other types of content, like sports content, that really does need to be alongside advertising in order for it to be a viable and economic approach. But you know, they had a great valuation, and it's been tempered a bit. My point of view on streaming is not that it's a bad thing. I think what I would like to see if I were in David Zaslav's shoes is that he moves a little bit closer to their valuation, and maybe they kind of came down to a more realistic valuation. And all things considered, I think it's going to be a strong and viable business moving forward as ultimately the early innings of this shake out and we get into a steady state. And I think David and Warner Brothers Discovery is well positioned for that.
And do you think the shutting down of CNN Plus was the right move based on what you knew?
I don't know. I wasn't in the room at the time. You know, David has, after the transaction closed, a lot of different, you know, considerations, his own strategies as to where he wants to take the business, his own decisions on how he wants to allocate capital. I'm not party to those conversations. I don't know what they were. And I'm sure within that context, he made a decision that he felt was best for the business.
So one last question, John, to wrap this up. You know, we also saw your business segment a little weak, and I'm wondering what other companies should be looking at for signals here in your report. Are businesses pulling back more broadly on spending, and should that be a warning sign about the economy?
You know, I don't think so, Emily. I think in our circumstance, you know, we have a very unique position in the business market. We are the largest provider of services to large complex organizations, and that's an envied position to have, but they're also the businesses that are going through the fastest rate of technology evolution, and they are orienting themselves away from traditional networks that used to be operated and managed exclusively by companies like us to software-defined networking, which ultimately shift some of the capabilities either to the company itself or into a hyperscaler environment. And that changes our role in those particular companies. And that's why, as a business, we're pivoting away from our strong position on the enterprise side. We'll continue to service those customers and meet their needs in the way we can match them. But we really want to strengthen our position in the mid-market. And our brand is very well positioned to do that. They're the types of customers who still need our expertise and our owned and operated infrastructure to run their companies. And we're underpenetrated there, and we have an opportunity for a great amount of growth as a result of that. So I don't think it's a weakness in business. In fact, I think networking is getting more and more important, both mobile and fixed, for all business customers. It's more of a pivot on technology and how we're positioning our company to line up against that.
Interesting. All right. AT&T CEO John Stankey. John, great to have you here on the show. Thank you for taking the time.
Thanks for having me in, Emily.
All right, coming up, a probe into one of Tesla's highest-ranking executives and a number of employees already fired, this according to Bloomberg sources. We'll talk about their role in a so-called secret project, a scoop from our own Ed Ludlow. Next, this is Bloomberg.
What if everyone at work were an expert communicator? What if every doc, message, and email they wrote was perfectly clear and concise? Inbox numbers would drop. Customer satisfaction scores would rise, and everyone would be more productive. That's where Grammarly comes in. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that understands your business and can transform it through better communication. Companies that use Grammarly save an average of 19 days per employee per year. That's because with Grammarly's AI, what used to take a few hours only takes a few clicks, like generating an instant first draft in your company voice or tailoring a message to your specific audience and goals. And Grammarly's personalized on-brand writing help is built in everywhere your team works, across 500,000 apps and websites. Plus, it's safe, secure, and already IT approved. Join 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly with their words and their data. Learn more at Grammarly.com. Grammarly, easier said, done.
Hi, I'm Ron Kruszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
One of Elon Musk's top lieutenants, the executive that runs Tesla's Texas factory, is now the focus of an internal investigation. According to Bloomberg sources, Tesla is looking into Omid Afshar for his role in a plan to purchase hard-to-get supplies that weren't for Tesla. Bloomberg's Ed Ludlow broke this story. He joins us now. So, Ed, who is Omid Afshar and what did he do?
Yeah, so Omid Afshar is Elon Musk's right-hand man. He used to be executive assistant, then he got promoted to be the director for projects of the office of the CEO. And more recently, he's basically overseen the construction of the Austin plant, Giga Texas, and now production that's taking place there. And according to sources, internally, the finance group and legal audit are looking at a procurement order from earlier this year for some glass. They want to know what the glass was going to be used for and if Omid Afshar knew about it or not. And ultimately, according to sources, one of the questions being asked was, is this glass going to be used by Elon Musk for a personal project, personal use? In other words, not for Tesla's own construction or a building associated with Tesla.
So what are we thinking here? Was this for an outside, quote unquote, secret project or a secret project for the CEO?
Yeah, so we don't know. Sources tell us that Omid Afshar instructed some Tesla employees to generate this procurement order, this PO, and told them literally that it was for a secret project. Beyond that, we don't have much more information. We know that the PO was generated much earlier this year, and that the consideration of the suspicion around it has been in place for a number of months through first Tesla's finance and internal audit team, and more recently their head of legal, David Searle, who was kind of looking into this and also looking into Omid's involvement.
A number of other employees, according to your reporting, have already lost their jobs over this. Is Omid Afshar, you know, is he gonna keep working at the company? Is he gonna go on a leave of absence?
So what we've been told, according to sources, is that people have been fired in connection to this. And we're told by sources that the consideration right now is that Omid Afshar will be put on a leave of absence. We don't have any timing of when that will take place. We, of course, asked Elon Musk, Tesla representatives for comment about this, and we haven't heard anything back. So we don't, frankly, know what Tesla's position is on all of this or, you know, the latest that's happening inside as of this afternoon, but that's what our reporting is.
Okay, Ed Ludlow, big scoop from you, Ed. Thank you. We'll continue to follow your reporting. Welcome back to Bloomberg Technology. I'm Emily Chang in San Francisco. This week, Apple published a 60-page report detailing its foray into the health tech business. This while Amazon has been building its own healthcare presence over the last few years. Now Amazon's latest salvo, buying primary care provider One Medical in an all-cash deal valued at $3.49 billion. One Medical operates 182 medical offices in 25 markets across the United States. Our Bloomberg Deals reporter Michelle Davis joins us now for more. So obviously we've known about Amazon's healthcare ambitions. This is an interesting turn though. Why is Amazon buying One Medical?
Yeah, so this is Amazon's third biggest deal after Whole Foods and MGM. And with this deal, Amazon gets, you know, access to One Medical's hundreds of thousands of customers, its relationships with employers, the app. And this is Amazon really, and Andy Jassy, you know, Amazon's new CEO, really trying to make its mark and really pushing into healthcare in a big way. They had bought a pill pack. You know, they were offering some virtual care through Amazon Care, but this is them really getting deep into the primary care market. The deal took some people by surprise, but I think, you know, knowing how good Amazon is with, like, manipulating data and analyzing it, it'll be really interesting to see what they do with One Medical, you know, how they use the Whole Foods channel, if they, you know, combine some of those things to offer, memberships or, like, services where you could get, blood pressure checked at Whole Foods or something like that, the way that you could deliver or return an Amazon package at Whole Foods.
Interesting. Wow. Never thought of that. Which brings me to my next question. For One Medical customers, what's going to change?
So there aren't that many details that we know so far about what Amazon plans to do with One Medical. We do know that One Medical had been burning cash pretty substantially. Its stock, as you probably know, has been on a roller coaster over the past few years since it IPO'd. And so what this will do is help it expand a little more quickly probably push into new markets. But beyond that, we're still waiting on more details from Amazon about what it plans to do.
Meantime, you've got Apple touting its own health tech offerings. Is this a space, an area where you expect to see M&A potentially pick up?
Definitely. There's been a huge trend of, you know, healthcare companies and tech companies converging. Last year alone, we saw two mega deals with Cerner or Oracle buying Cerner, a health records company, Microsoft buying Nuance, a data company. A lot of these deals are about access to data. And Google has also signaled ambitions into healthcare. It obviously has devices. I do think, and the people I talk to say that this is going to continue, especially now that Amazon has made this big push. It's a signal to the other tech players to, you know, do something to punch back.
All right, Michelle Davis, we'll continue to watch your reporting on this. Thank you. I want to stay with this story now. I'm bringing Christina Farr, principal investor at Omers Ventures and a former health reporter who had been reporting on Amazon's ambitions in healthcare for years. Chrissy, a lot of people didn't believe you that Amazon was really going to go deep here, and here they are. What do you make of One Medical being added to the portfolio?
Oh, it's just absolutely massive news, Emily, and it's really a long time coming. I first started reporting on Amazon having ambitions in the space back in 2017. Pharmacy was really the first leg of the stool, and then you saw them tackling telemedicine with Amazon Care, and now they've moved into primary care with One Medical. Not only primary care in the sense of consumer cash pay primary care, but One Medical has networks and relationships with lots of employers across the country. They have their own medical record that they built from the ground up. So they also have healthcare software that will be amazing for Amazon to access, and no doubt kind of part of the reasoning behind this deal. So I think where they go from here, they're really the sky is the limit, and I can see them integrating all of these offerings into something very powerful.
What exactly does that look like to you? I mean, are we going to be getting our blood pressure checked at Whole Foods? Do patients even want that?
I think all of these things are absolutely possible. I mean, what they fundamentally recognized here is that the future of healthcare is hybrid. It's not just telemedicine, it's not just virtual, and it's not brick and mortar either. It's something in between, because you can't really do everything from home as much as we would love to. But eventually you will need to go somewhere to get your blood pressure checked if you need it. So yes, that's a possibility. Blood pressure checks at Whole Foods, why not? And, you know, while we're at it, I could absolutely see Whole Foods expanding deeper into pharmacy as well. That's just one of the kind of many directions that they could go with this buy-up. I think at the end of the day, how I see it is fundamentally about Amazon's obsession with the customer. And they've been saying this for decades now, first with books, and then they moved into other areas of retail. And so this just seems so obvious to me, because it was really the last piece of their retail empire that they hadn't conquered, healthcare. So now, you know, they're signaled to the industry that this is something that they are moving into, and they're deadly serious about it.
There have been some comparisons to Kaiser here. Do you think that Amazon could potentially be a competitor to Kaiser?
It's a great question. I think of Kaiser more in the sense of, you know, imagine if Kaiser was starting today, what would they build? And that's really kind of the question that Amazon has in front of them. They wanted to be one of the most innovative healthcare care delivery companies. What would they do? And I think that involves having it all, having, you know, the pharmacy piece, the lab and diagnostic piece, having that primary care piece as well. And then I think too about what they could do with the referral networks that they're building with health systems. How do you send send patients to the right care at the right time. And that really is the promise here, Emily, that for years the space has been talking about building a true front door to healthcare. You're a patient, you need help. What do you do next? How do you access care at the right price? And I think that's really what Amazon could do, and they could be the first player to do it.
Well, it hasn't all gone right. Amazon, for example, that JP Morgan healthcare venture with Berkshire Hathaway collapsed. It didn't last very long. Meantime, you've got Apple pushing into this business. You know, how do you see Amazon differentiating itself from, let's say, an Apple? I mean, just yesterday we were asking if Apple might buy Peloton. Could that be something of interest to Amazon as well?
I think Peloton could be of interest to both companies. The difference I see with Amazon, though, is they could really do something in actual healthcare services and delivery because they're not afraid of low-margin businesses. When you look at some of their big tech competitors, they're used to kind of SaaS-like software margins, and with Apple, it's a hardware play at its core. So it doesn't make as much sense to be in the actual provision of healthcare that it might for Amazon, which is really a supply chain and logistics company. So I think Amazon really has the biggest promise here of all of the big tech companies to do something very real. And then you mentioned Haven, which is a great point. That was not a successful venture. They teamed up with two other big employers to try to do something in that space. But to me, you know, when I was back at CNBC and this all was unveiled, it was kind of felt like a little bit of a distraction that maybe the real healthcare push would happen behind the scenes. And I think that's exactly what's happened.
All right, Christina Farr, really interesting to hear your perspective here. We'll continue to watch where this goes. Investor at Omers Ventures, thank you for joining us. All right, coming up, the energy crisis and Bitcoin mining. We're going to talk to a mining giant, Core Scientific, about why it had to dump most of its Bitcoin holdings last month. That's next. This is Bloomberg.
What if everyone at work were an expert communicator? What if every doc, message, and email they wrote was perfectly clear and concise? Inbox numbers would drop. Customer satisfaction scores would rise, and everyone would be more productive. That's where Grammarly comes in. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that understands your business and can transform it through better communication. Companies that use Grammarly save an average of 19 days per employee per year. That's because with Grammarly's AI, what used to take a few hours only takes a few clicks, like generating an instant first draft in your company voice or tailoring a message to your specific audience and goals. And Grammarly's personalized on-brand writing help is built in everywhere your team works, across 500,000 apps and websites. Plus, it's safe, secure, and already IT approved. Join 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly with their words and their data. Learn more at Grammarly.com. Grammarly, easier said, done.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
It's time now for our crypto report, and Bloomberg has learned U.S. authorities have arrested a former Coinbase product manager in an alleged insider trading scheme. People familiar with the matter say Ishan Wahi leaked insider information to help his brother and a friend buy tokens just before they were listed on the crypto exchange. I want to bring in our crypto contributor, Shanali Bostic, for more details on this story. Shanali, what happened?
Yeah, this was just a massive Bloomberg scoop here, Emily, and you have both federal prosecutors as well as the SEC taking a look at what happened here at Coinbase. Coinbase with an employee who helped oversee listings, allegedly tipping off his friend and brother here about the listings. Remember, when listings of tokens happen, that tends to improve liquidity of those tokens and therefore is quite material here. I want to point out this quote here from the Damian Williams of this of the Manhattan U.S. Attorney's Office. And he's really saying that this is a further reminder here that Web3 in particular here is not a total law-free zone. So in addition to the SEC here, you now have federal prosecutors taking a look at insider trading again for the first time in cryptocurrency. So certainly a landmark case that affected a Coinbase employee, and Coinbase itself has taken a look at the issue themselves.
Fraud is fraud is fraud there from the Manhattan U.S. attorney. Okay, Coinbase has been under pressure already because of this crypto route, which, by the way, where are we in the markets today? Things have actually been looking green.
They have been looking green. We are flipping to the green here again after a couple of days of weakness. And remember, this is a month where you've seen crypto actually jump once again after declining, ending the month, ending last month, less than $19,000 in the red, really. We're really... had seen a really deep sell-off in crypto winter, but you are back to seeing gains now back above 23K. Remember, it started last month above 30K, above 31K, so we have a while to go before recouping all of last month's gains, but we are indeed, to your point, climbing back.
All right, Shanali, thank you. Hang on, I want you to join us for this next conversation because we're going to talk a little bit more about this and the impact of the crypto winter on crypto mining. Mike Levitt joining us now. He's the CEO and co-founder of Core Scientific, which is one of the largest publicly traded blockchain data center providers and miners of digital assets in North America. Mike, thank you so much for joining us. So first of all, what's your take on what's going on in the crypto markets right now? Obviously, we've seen a lot of red. We're seeing a bit of a turnaround now. Nobody knows if this is a long-term sustainable rally or if this is just a blip. I know it's hot where you are, but it's certainly feeling cold if you're an investor. What's your take?
Well, first, thank you for having me. And you're right, it is hot where I am. It's about 102 degrees here in Austin, Texas. And of course, that heat wave is running across the entire South. What I think I would say we really are seeing is, first of all, a period in our industry that happens with many growing and nascent industries, where in fact rationalization and some cleansing occurs. And when you take market pressure, macroeconomic pressure, pressure on technology, and the pressure in our industries, what you're seeing is a tumultuous period of time. That said, and Shanali referenced it, we've seen Bitcoin come back a bit, and we're very happy to see some stability in the pricing of digital assets.
Now, we've seen Bitcoin mining companies, which, you know, they're normally big holders, selling their assets. You just dumped a huge portion of your Bitcoin a month ago. Why? And do you wish you didn't at this point?
No, I can't say that I regret what we have done. But we produce a lot of Bitcoin every month. We're currently running at a pace of 1,200 Bitcoin a month and expect for that to grow considerably over the course of this year as we continue to invest in both our servers and our infrastructure. There are a couple of considerations that are axiomatic when you're running a production business. One is you have to make sure you've got enough capital or cash to pay your bills when due. And we produce Bitcoin, but our obligations are in dollars. So we need to make sure we generate enough dollars to pay those obligations. Second is in these distressed or tumultuous environments, liquidity is very important. If you've got liquidity, one, you both make sure that your business is built to survive. And second, it puts you in a position to take advantage of opportunities that arise in a distressed marketplace. And so we made a strategic decision that it would behoove us to become much more liquid on our balance sheet to give us a lot more flexibility to take advantage of the situation we see in the coming months.
Yeah, and the coming months there are some other issues too, and that is indeed, you guys were talking about it before, and it's the weather. And so the heat wave that you're seeing, how is this going to continually impact operations, and what can you do to get around it?
Well, you're right, it is hot. it's very hot across the South. It's very hot where I live in Austin, Texas. And as you've probably discussed with others before me, one of the beauties of our industry is that our production can be adapted to demand response. And so in situations like this, we quite often curtail or downpower machines to make sure that we're providing the support to the grid that's necessary so that consumers and others aren't impacted. As we sit here in Texas at this very moment, we have in fact curtailed our operations for the afternoon at the request of ERCOT. That said, there are roughly 5,000 excess or reserve megawatt hours available, 5,200 to be exact, megawatts available right now for the Texas grid. By downpowering, what we as a mining industry have done is provided more cushion to the system here in Texas.
Mm-hmm. And I also want to talk about liquidity, because you see this also issue affect others as well. You have Tesla saying, for example, that their selling shouldn't be seen as a verdict on Bitcoin, but wasn't a concern about liquidity of the company overall. But this is so soon after Elon Musk also said that Tesla had diamond hands. So how do you reconcile both things, that such a large believer and a corporate buyer of Bitcoin really could now have to sell because of the broader market issues?
Well, it's although I don't know Tesla's finances intimately, I do happen to own one of their cars, and my son was smarter than me and happens to own their stock. But that said, I think it's a smart business move to get more liquid in an environment like this. As I understand it, both Elon personally as well as the company continue to have considerable holdings. But as I said, we decided that it made good business sense to get more liquid, and it seems that Tesla decided to do the same. These markets have been moving very quickly. The conditions have been very uncertain, a lot of volatility, and so I understand why they would decide to create a little bit more cash on their balance sheet.
All right. Mike Leavitt, CEO and co-founder of Core Scientific, and our own Shanali Bosick. Really interesting, Mike. Thank you for joining us. Amazon is starting to deliver with Rivian's electric vans. Amazon has a major investment in the electric car maker and plans to use at least 100,000 of its vans in the United States. R. Ed Ludlow sat down with Amazon's vice president of transportation to talk about the partnership.
By the end of the year, we're going to have thousands of electric vehicles delivering to millions of customers in over 100 major U.S. towns. Our focus really is around sustainability. And we partnered with Rivian because we really believe that they shared in our mission around decarbonization. And we thought together we could do something that would reinvent, reimagine what a sustainable fleet could look like.
Meantime, Rivian CEO RJ Scaringe also spoke to Ed about the rollout.
As our production is continuing to ramp and we're building more and more vans, simultaneous to that, Amazon's ramping the number of their centers that can accept and ingest all these vans. So that's everything from charging infrastructure to making sure the drivers are ready. So it's a really close partnership as we plan out, you know, what it looks like when you go from hundreds to thousands to tens of thousands to, you know, 100,000 vans within their system.
How is the ramp of Rivian Prime van going? Because at the same time, you're ramping R1T, introducing R1S.
Yeah.
Is the van experiencing the same supply chain issues that the consumer vehicles have?
The van and the consumer vehicle are similar in that they have the same core technology backbone. So the electronic stack, our network architecture, elements of the propulsion platform. But obviously, the rest of it's very different, the body, the interior. So in some of the areas where we're constrained, like semiconductors, that has been a challenge over the last 6 months. But with regards to the way the vehicles are produced in the plant, we have two separate lines. So you could almost think of it as two plants housed on the same campus. And so the R1 line produces the truck and now our SUV. And the commercial vehicle line produces this, the 700 cubic foot version of the van. And then there's also a narrower and shorter one, which we call the 500. So launching four different vehicles on two different lines over the last 6 months has certainly been challenging with this the supply chain backdrop, of course, with the pandemic backdrop, but the teams have really come together to deliver on that. We've been hyper-focused on ramp, you know, living in the plant, so to speak, to get the production ramped up, and we're excited about the back half of this year.
Amazon is a global company, and they operate in jurisdictions outside of the U.S. Mm-hmm. Do you see a future where Rivian manufactures vans in the markets where Amazon would hope to deploy them?
Yeah, to start, we have our production facility here in Illinois, not far from here.
Not far, yeah.
But as our commercial business scales, of course, we'll have to ultimately have multiple plants producing commercial vans. And to really go into those other major markets, having localized or regionally localized production is key. So as you think about Europe as a market, in the long term, we'll certainly have to put production there.
Bloomberg has reported that Rivian is considering a round of layoffs or reduction in force, but those roles will be outside of manufacturing, the folks building the actual stuff. Have you made any progress on that? What is the kind of thinking there?
Yeah, one of the things we've talked about, even in some of our earnings calls, is the need for us to be hyper-focused on the right set of objectives, given the economic climate that we're in. So that's ramping our R1T, our R1S, our commercial vehicles in our Normal facility. That's developing and launching and ramping our R2 platform. That's building out all of our go-to-market parts of the business. And importantly, that's also driving profitability into the business, or driving a level of cost efficiency in the business. So we've gone through the rationalization of all the different things we're doing, and has created opportunities for us to more efficiently structure parts of the team. And we're working through that process. These are some of the hardest decisions, you know, a leader has to take in running a business. And certainly we're trying to be as intentional and as thoughtful in terms of what that means for the business, what that means for the individuals as we work through that process. But as you said, this doesn't impact our manufacturing teams. This is really more heavily in some other aspects of the business.
Rivian CEO RJ Scaringe there with our own Ed Ludlow. You can catch more of that interview, of course, at Bloomberg.com. And that does it for this edition of Bloomberg Technology. Friday, we're going to be talking everything crypto. Bitwise CIO Matt Hogan will be joining us, including a discussion about their potential lawsuit against the SEC. And don't forget to check out our podcast, as always, wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Emily Chang in San Francisco. This is Bloomberg.
Do you love Elon Musk? Do you hate Elon Musk? Do you have no idea what to think about Elon Musk? Then we have just the show for you.
He's become even more larger than life.
Buying Twitter doesn't get us closer to Mars.
They are like really close to the edge of like everything falling apart.
Like, oh, Elon, I volunteer, put a chip in my brain.
Each week on this podcast, we'll break down, analyze, and debate the most important stories on Musk and his empire.
It's all one big universe. You just work for Elon Inc.
From Bloomberg Businessweek, this is Elon Inc. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.